Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell. I'm sitting across from Peter Fitzsimons, who has come to talk to us about his new book, Burke and Wills. Welcome.
Thank you, John. Nice to be here again. I'm about to sign up a storm.
It's going to be massive, massive
signing. 1,500 books, post-war record.
This new book returns to the era of a lot of people's favourite book on Australian history, Ned Kelly.
Yeah. Funny, Neil Mitchell, who I'm sure you know, is the host of 3AW from 9 to 12 a.m., Victoria's answer to John Laws back in the day, except Neil Mitchell endures and goes very well. But he said to me a couple of interviews ago, he said, we should make you an honorary Victorian for the number of books I do with Victorian history. And I was thinking about it, he's quite right, because I started out with Eureka Stockade, which is a killer story. Ned Kelly, also a very Victorian story. And this one, Burke and Wills. And people forget that Melbourne in the 1860s didn't need to bow before Paris. Paris would bow before Melbourne. Mm. Melbourne was built out of the wealth of Ballarat, the Ballarat goldfields. And if you look at Parliament House these days, I mean, that was built. Melbourne University was built out of that. All of those grand structures, those grand churches, it was magnificent. And so in the latter part of the 1850s, the idea was, and so a lot of it was goldfields wealth, but there was also squatters' wealth, pastoral wealth, of these the extraordinarily fertile lands. So the idea, they looked at the map, and I think it was the Age or the Argus in 1858, said we have to fill in the ghastly blank that lies in the middle of Australia. 80% of Australia had never had a white man set foot into it. So they started off this idea for this expedition. And in the modern day, hopefully, for such an expedition, you'd think you'd go, well, who's the best qualified? Who can we find to lead this expedition who needs to have a good sense of direction, needs to be a bushman, or these days we'd quite rightly say, or a bushwoman, we wouldn't care about gender, but we'd want a superbly qualified leader to do it who can make his way in the bush or her way. Anyway, back then they go, well, what about Burke? What about Robert O'Hara Burke? Well known at the Melbourne Club, and the key movers and shakers all liked him. He was a big drinker, he was a big card player, big gambler, great guy, great company, a little bit mad, but you could get your head around, you could move from that. And anyway, they picked Robert O'Hara Burke to lead the expedition. And the police that knew him were aghast. He was notorious for the fact that even though he was the inspector at Beechworth, 5 miles from Beechworth on a sunny day, he'd get lost even, you know, on the roads, and he wouldn't know the difference between north and south. And he was not a bad man, but a very temperamental man, very moody man, and look, just a little bit mad. His deputy that he picked was William Landells. And anyway, as they head off, they have 19 men heading off with about 19 tons of material. So the idea was, we're white fellas, we're heading off into black fella territory, we need to take everything that of the white fella world with us. Mm. And it was 19 tons. And they had a dining room table, they had stiff back chairs, they had everything they could possibly need. 2 years of food materials. The thing that most stunned me, they had state-of-the-art enema syringes, okay, just in case you needed an enema, God knows, and dandruff kits.
Was there anyone standing around going, boys, you don't need all this? Was there anyone there with a sensible word for them?
Well, the interesting thing is that when they disappeared into the gaping maw of Australia, they sent an actual bushman out after them to find them. And it was like following a circus through the middle of Australia with the detritus that was left behind them, because they just kept shedding stuff. We don't need this, we don't need that. I must say, I resonated a little bit with me when I started walking the Kokoda Track, which was one of my books 15 years ago. I started out with, you know, probably 20 kilos in my pack. And by the time I finished, I had 10 kilos in my pack, because I looked at every single thing I was carrying up those damn mountains. Do I need this? Do I need that? I don't need it. And they were exactly like that. They shed and they shed and they shed.
I just imagine someone coming over a hill and finding a beautiful dining table or set for dinner.
Well, they also
by itself or abandoned.
Well, one of their carriages that they took, one of the carts, was amphibious. You know, it was basically, if there's an inland sea, we're going to need to go over that anyway. Halfway up, they go, "There's no inland sea." That was the end of that.
Were there people? I mean, I'm assuming that there are people out there, especially squatters. I can imagine these guys coming in from the edge of known universe for these guys, coming back and you know, hardened by their travels and also interacting with the indigenous population, who could have given these guys a bit of a hand.
Yes, they could have, and they looked for local. I mean, as they got to Menindi, they headed further north. They were looking for the locals that could guide them, and one of the locals that they hired, Wright. I mean, that is a huge part of the saga, that Burke put all of his trust into Wright, and whether Wright betrayed him or whether the problem was that Burke didn't give him written instructions, he gave him verbal instructions, and in fact, as a matter of fact, he gave him a dozen verbal instructions, some of which contradicted each other. Mm. But he was a hopeless leader. The interesting thing with Burke, I suppose I look, my touchstones of leadership, they started out in football. So I've been under great captaincy, great coaching, and I've been under ordinary captaining and ordinary coaching. And Burke was not, by my touchstones, a great leader of men. He did not, you know, he was essentially a good man with a good heart, but he wanted to do something famous to earn the love of a very young actress that had rejected him. She was 16 years old when he fell in love with her, which is a bit problematic, frankly, by our standards.
Yeah.
He was 37, I think, at the time. Very interesting for me that Burke, as he leaves, gives this young actress, Julia Matthews, a locket, a photo of himself to hang around her neck while Wills gives his own portrait, and he was 26-year-old astronomer. He gives his own portrait to a 54-year-old male lawyer. Now, I don't suggest they were partners, but I do suggest, I mean, when you read the letters between them, there was a love between these men in a Victorian manner, which is fascinating, just fascinating. And it was this fellow, Richard Burney, was his mentor and opened him up to the world of Shakespeare, of poetry, of love, William Moth, and the astronomy. And at one point, Wills is walking along with Richard Burney and he gazes at the sky and he says, "Oh, Richard, Shakespeare, what is it? What is it, William? If only Shakespeare was an astronomer." What, you know, and it was fascinating because this burgeoning intellect, and Wills was a very good man. And what happened to him, so in the well-known part of the story, they get to Cooper's Creek, exhausted, but they decide, Burke decides, we're going to have a rocket party to get, not a rocket, that's not the terminology of the time, but a flying squad. We're going to leave five men here, and we're going to have four men, by this time they'd shed a dozen men. But we're going to leave five men here and four of us will go to the Gulf to get back. And as they leave, Robert O'Hara Burke says to the man he's leaving in charge, William Bray, "Stay here for 3 months. If we're not back in 3 months, we're not coming back." Wills takes Bray aside and says, "Stay here for 4 months," just to be on the safe side. Anyway, 4 months and 4 days later, on the morning of the 21st of April 1861, there at the depot at Cooper's Creek, William Bray does what he did every day. He looks to the north. He's looking for signs, any signs that they're coming back. And at 10 o'clock in the morning, he gives the order, they're not coming back, so they move to the south. That night, 7 o'clock, into the camp, more dead than alive, come the three survivors of that four-man party. And cooey, cooey, cooey. They're gone, and there, you know, on a tree is carved the words "dig," now known as the Dig Tree. They dig down and they find supplies, and they originally think, well, you know, with these supplies we'll be okay, but it's one, and those supplies did indeed keep them alive for a while. But the tragedy is, at that point, the rescue party, the supply party, was only 14 miles away.
Mm.
With a concerted effort, they actually could have caught them up. And they knew that they were not that far away, because they knew that only left that morning.
Mm.
And it's so what then happens is the three survivors traipse up and down Cooper's Creek looking for a way out, relying initially on the kindness of the Aboriginal people, and they were very kind. And until at one point, while Wills goes back to the dig tree to see if there's anybody that's been there, the Aborigines approach Burke with offerings of food. Burke, a very mistrustful man, pulls out his gun and fires it over their head. And I suppose the things that I enjoyed most about the book was looking at the accounts of the Indigenous people at that time. There's one scene where one of the rescue parties that goes out to find them happens upon a tribal war where there are 30 Indigenous men standing in a field, and about 50 yards away is another 30 men, and they've all got their weapons, and the two elders walk out to talk to each other. They go back, then one elder throws a boomerang and the elder catches it. Then the second elder from the other side throws his boomerang, catches it, and the instant he catches it, both tribes, it's like the whistle blowing in a football match, and they race at each other and they beat the bejesus out of each other for 30 minutes with nulla nullas, with their fists, with their feet, and they seriously hurt each other, but they don't kill each other because they don't have spears. So it was like a football game of the time over territory, and you just get these glimpses of Indigenous Australia at that time. And another scene that I absolutely love, the explorers gave their shirts, they gave things to the tribes, and one of the Indigenous men, a very noble looking man with an enormous charisma, put the shirt on and wouldn't take it off, and they called him Mr. Shirt. And Mr. Shirt was initially very accommodating of the explorers until he realised they're not moving on. And he said to them, listen, you've got to keep moving. You know, this land belongs to us, and you've got to keep going. Anyway, they were fascinated by Mr. Shirt's charisma, and they couldn't understand his language, but one of the ones that's recording his view says he was just like a real diplomat. It's amazing, you know, blackfellow was actually being really persuasive. And Mr. Shirt loses his patience, at which point an Indigenous woman over his shoulder, they can't understand what she's saying by the actual words because they don't understand the language, but her meaning is clear. She's saying, kill the bastards, get them out, kill them. Anyway, the following morning they attack, and there is Mr. Shirt leading his men to move the white fellows on, and they line him up and they shoot him, and he goes down and he gets up again and they shoot him again. And then his Indigenous brothers drag him away, and all through the night they can hear the Indigenous woman wailing in the night until somewhere before dawn she stops, presumably because he had died.
When I was growing up and we had told the story of Burke and Wills, I mean, I'd never actually gone into it in much detail, but you sort of have this idea of it. Mm. I always got the sense that these twits went out in the middle of nowhere, didn't get very far, then died. How far did they actually go?
Well, this is the other thing. This is the fascinating thing. I mean, Burke was hopeless. Burke was not a bushman at all. He was not a leader of men at all. But the one thing he delivered, he was dogged. He was persistent. He kept going till he dropped. And the interesting thing is that despite all the stuff-ups, despite the ludicrous amount of material they took with us, the hopeless people they hired, the wagons that were too heavy, all of the things that they did wrong, despite it all, he got to within 9 hours of success. Had they, at one point, Charlie Gray, who was the fourth member of the party going to the Gulf of Carpentaria, on the 17th of April, he died, which is to say they were 4 days from getting back to the depot. They spent a day burying him. They were exhausted, but they did spend a day. Now, if they hadn't spent that day, if they just said, Charlie's dead and we're just going to move, they would have got there in time. They would have got to join up with the other party. Suddenly, instead of being four men with no supplies, they would have been nine men with animals, with supplies. They would have got through and got back. And
so how far is Cooper's Creek from where they started? Like, we're talking halfway across about Australia?
In the old money, about 1,200 miles. A long, long way north. Yeah. But when they got to Cooper's Creek, they still have a hell of a long way to go. Mm. I mean, right in the guts of Australia. Mm. And but that's the interesting thing. Despite it all, Burke still led his men to the point that they were within 9 hours of victory of, and they would have come back, he would have come back to Melbourne, he would have no doubt earned the love of Julia Matthews, the love of his life, even though she was not sure about him, and he would have been the most iconic figure in Australian exploration. In the end, he is the most iconic figure, but he's not known as a success, he's known as a failure.
So what's this about Australia where we've got Eureka Stockade didn't really end well, Ned Kelly didn't really end well.
Interesting.
Burke and Wells didn't really
end well.
That's
a very interesting point. We love our sagas where our people just miss, don't we?
Mm.
Yeah, that is very interesting.
And you've made a study of it.
I suppose I have. I mean, you
Gallipoli?
Well, Gallipoli is the most obvious example. Noble failures.
Mm.
I'm trying to think of... Well, Kokoda was not a noble failure. Kokoda was a great victory. But, yeah, that is a very, very interesting point. And Burke and Wells was a tragic saga, but it's a fascinating saga of the times. It's a saga of the times, but what a venture it was. My favourite story, I suppose I don't want to give out all the stories, but when you're researching it and you just come across these things, you just go, that is fabulous.
Mm.
And when the bushman that they sent out with his party of three to find Burke and Wills, when he finds one of them alive, so he discovers one of his men, Edwin Welch, they get to Cooper's Creek and they're sort of going up left and right looking along Cooper's Creek, and one of his men, Edwin Welch, is taking his horse through a creek, and there he sees a group of Indigenous people on the other side, and they scatter, and there's one man left on his knees, and he says something along the lines of, "What manner of a scarecrow of man is this?" And the scarecrow speaks and he says, "I am king, sir." "What? You speak English?" "Yes, sir." "Where are you from?" I am from the expedition with Mr. Burke." "Where are they?" "They are dead, sir."
Mm.
And this bushman takes John King back, and the stuff of John King when he gets back to Melbourne goes berserk in a manner that you cannot imagine. Everybody wanted a piece of him. Everybody wanted to touch him, to see him. And he's just overwhelmed, completely overwhelmed. Almost a Diana moment, an early version of the Diana moment, in that this John King, who was a 21-year-old Irishman who'd seen service in India, come to Australia, found himself on this expedition, did well, was one of the survivors who'd been to the top with Burke and Wills, and always spoke, to be fair, fairly well about Burke and Wills, is suddenly a celebrity like they don't make them anymore. But then the committee, the Royal Committee that sent Burke and Wills out there, says to the bushman that's brought them back, "Well, where are the bodies?" You know, he says, "Well, I buried them. You know, we buried them. Of course we buried them." He says, "Well, go and get them." So he did. So he had to go back. 2 years later, he comes back, and my favourite scene in the entire book, 23rd of December, 1862, I guess, he's gone up to the Cooper's Creek, he's retrieved the bodies, he's come down through Mount Hopeless, gone Cooper's Creek to Mount Hopeless, down to Adelaide, gets on a ship, and the ship comes into Port Phillip Bay, and there are the members of the Royal Committee waiting for the bones to come back, and they come down, it's 5:30 in the morning, all is still, and down come the sailors bearing, they're not coffins, but they're more like coffers because they're very small. They get them back to the Royal Society Halls on Collins Street. They open them up, and there are these two bags covered in the Union Jack, one marked Burke, one marked Wills. And with their scissors, they open up the one with Burke, and there is his skull. And they, you know, it's a real, alas, poor Yorick, I knew him well moment. And they pass, these eight men of the committee, pass this skull around among them. All is silent until tinkle, 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 tinkle. They look down aghast. Burke's teeth have fallen out on the floor.
Oh.
I mean, it's just, it's filled with stuff like that. It is just amazing.
Peter, thank you very much for coming in and talking to us about Burke and Wills. It sounds extraordinary, and it's going to be probably the biggest non-fiction title this Christmas for giving to dad, uncles, brothers, sisters, mothers, who else we got?
Aunts,
grandmothers, daughters. Grandfathers, daughters,
godsons, friends,
yeah.
History buffs.
Pretty much for everyone. No, beyond history buffs, that's what I'm trying to get across, because these books are teaching Australia, all those people who went through school and ignored their Australian history, you one by one are bringing them back to
well,
back
I'll
to
say
history.
This. Look, I mean, sometimes you hear people say, you know, Australian history is dull. No, it's not. It is fucking fabulous. It's fantastic. It's colourful. It's exotic. It's inspiring. It's devastating. It's everything. But anybody that tells you Australian history is dull does not have the first fucking clue.
We just need the right teacher, and you are the right teacher. Thank you.
I don't
very
know
much,
if Peter. I'm a teacher, but I'm a yarn spinner. But this is true.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you.
And you can get all of Peter Simon's books at booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.